From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is preparing to send two articles of impeachment to the Senate next week, signaling the start of the impeachment trial. Meanwhile, the House passed a resolution yesterday limiting President Trump's ability to attack Iran after Trump ordered the targeted killing of an Iranian general without consulting Congress. Last night at a rally in Toledo, President Trump took aim at Speaker Pelosi and presidential candidate Bernie Sanders.
But here's a guy who slaughtered and butchered civilians all over and military, whoever was in his way. And we have Bernie and Nancy Pelosi. We have them all. They're all trying to say, how dare you take him out that way? You should get permission from Congress. You should come in and tell us what you want to do.
Joining us now is our Friday Politics Roundtable, Tolu Olorunipa, who is White House reporter for The Washington Post. Hi, Tolu.
Hey there.
And Rick Klein, political director for ABC News. Hi, Rick.
Great to be with you.
Well, what about this news today on impeachment? Now we know the articles are likely to be transmitted to the Senate next week. Rick, what are you hearing? When is the trial going to start?
The delay is finally over. The trial could start as soon as Wednesday. That's a critical date. It's the day after the next Democratic primary debate, so it means the senators can stay seated for that time. And it's not clear what Nancy Pelosi will have achieved in this. It now appears like that she will be sending these over with votes teed up on the House managers and other procedural motions by Tuesday or so. So we're eyeballing the middle of the week for the beginning of a trial.
And Tolu, one thing that maybe she achieved, I'm not sure if this was her plan or not, but is that if the trial is in process when the president gives his State of the Union speech on February 4th, he won't be able to get up there and say, look, I was acquitted by the Senate. Is that what part of the delay was about?
No one would say that publicly, but I'm sure that Nancy Pelosi knows the timing and the schedule better than anyone else, and she may have considered not only the fact that the Senate Republicans had said that they're going to be coordinating with the president, that they're already planning on ways to dismiss these articles of impeachment against the president, but also the fact that as time plays out, more people will pay attention to the fact that there are questions about witnesses and who should testify, and the fact that President Trump is going to have to address the nation at a time where he likely will be in the middle of a trial for his survival.
Yeah. Speaking of witnesses, Rick, one big question is whether former National Security Advisor John Bolton will testify about his knowledge about withholding that military aid to Ukraine for investigations of Joe Biden. Bolton has offered to testify, which really begs the question, how can Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell say he's conducting a fair trial if he's not willing to hear from a witness with key information?
Yeah, the pressure will be immense, and I think it's going to fall to the members of the Senate. It won't be McConnell's call. It's going to be whatever 51 senators decide. And those are the key pressure points that Democrats are going to be focused in on. I think rather than the broad structural questions, it could be a question of witness by witness. Do you think a majority of senators, do you want to vote? And then it puts some pressure on some moderate Republicans who may want to actually get to the facts of this and may want to demonstrate that they are doing their duty as senators.
Yeah. Yesterday at the White House, President Trump actually asked whether Bolton will testify. He was asked that.
Well, that's going to be up to the lawyers. It'll be up to the Senate, and we'll see how they feel. He would know nothing about what we're talking about.
Tolu, aside from not wanting Bolton to testify, what does the White House want to see in this trial?
Well, they've gone back and forth for the past several weeks about what they want. At one point, President Trump said he wanted a robust trial with witnesses that he believed would be politically advantageous to him, including, you know, calling Adam Schiff as a witness, calling Hunter Biden and Joe Biden up to testify. Now it seems like they want something more quick that would have a definitive dismissal of these charges against the president so he can say that he was exonerated, he was acquitted by the Senate. He wants this over with pretty quickly. So it seems like they do not want some of these major witnesses, including John Bolton and Mick Mulvaney, to testify, even though they would have direct knowledge about what the president did in terms of his relations with Ukraine in 2019.
This is all going on, of course, as we are watching the increased tensions with Iran. And in his column yesterday, former George W. Bush speechwriter David Frum held President Trump responsible for the deaths of 176 people on that Ukrainian jet shot down in Iran. Rick, isn't this exactly the kind of misstep, if that's what it was, and a missile was shot by the Iranians by mistake, Isn't this exactly the kind of misstep that many people warned would be more likely with tensions raised so high between the U.S. and Iran as a result of the killing of Soleimani?
That's one of the things that these tensions mean, is that people are on that hair trigger. And you wonder what the reaction would be in the United States right now if those were American citizens and not Canadian citizens, say, on board that aircraft. It raises questions about what exactly we're in right now, because as the president and the White House continues to explain what pretext there was for taking out Soleimani, it becomes more evident that the strategy after that is critical here. And we can't be responsible for everything the Iranians do, but the tensions are at a higher point, and it does raise that possibility of either calculated or miscalculated atrocities or fallout.
There's also a lot of anger on Capitol Hill about the intelligence briefings that the members of Congress got from the administration this week. Reporters today asked Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to explain the shifting rationales for the targeted killing.
We had specific information on an imminent threat, and those threat stream included attacks on U.S. embassies. Period. Full stop.
You were mistaken when you said you didn't know precisely when and you didn't know precisely where.
Nope, completely true. Those are completely consistent thoughts. I don't know exactly which minute. We don't know exactly which day it would have been executed.
Tolu, isn't the administration going to have to provide more information about the threat that they acted on?
Well, they have had a really hard time providing a consistent message. Even the information that they put out so far has been inconsistent. So not only will they need to provide more information, but they need to get in a room and figure out what their message is about, what this threat was, whether it was imminent, whether it involved specific embassies, which President Trump said the embassy in Baghdad was a target. We've heard from other officials that they did not bring that up in this closed-door briefing with the Senate. So they need to figure out a way to put out a message to show that there was a reason for to carrying out this highly provocative strike on an Iranian official to take him out off the field because it was an imminent threat. And if it wasn't imminent, then that is part of the reason that a bipartisan group of members of Congress are saying that we should be involved. We have a role here in terms of the War Powers Act. And right now, the administration has not been able to provide answers to mollify those concerns in the House and in the Senate.
Let's talk a little bit more about that. Eight Democrats bucked their party and voted against a war powers resolution yesterday. Three Republicans did too, voting yes to limit the president's military actions against Iran. One of them was Trump supporter Matt Gaetz of Florida.
I support the president. Killing Soleimani was the right decision, but engaging in another forever war in the Middle East would be the wrong decision, and that's why I'm voting for this resolution.
Rick, is the Senate likely to follow suit next week? What would that mean?
Well, it'll be an interesting dynamic in the Senate because you have a number of more libertarian-minded or institutionally-minded senators, Mike Lee and Rand Paul, both of whom said they were dissatisfied by the briefing the administration put forward that are voting there. So even though this is largely toothless, it's largely a symbolic vote, I do think the way that it scrambles party lines in even the slightest of ways, it's surprising these days when anyone crosses party lines. So to have those numbers, and including a Trump supporter voting with the Democrats, is something to take note of.
Yeah, let's move on now to the 2020 presidential election. Billionaire Tom Steyer became the latest candidate to qualify for the next Democratic debate Tuesday night. New polls show him pulling in the double digits, which is the top four in Nevada and South Carolina. Tolu, is this surprising?
It is somewhat surprising, but there have been a lot of surprising things about this race.
Yeah.
It just shows that if you have $1 billion and you can put millions of dollars on air in some of these states, including South Carolina and Nevada, where some of these other candidates are struggling just to, you know, get their name recognition up in Iowa and New Hampshire, it does allow for movement in the polls, and it does allow someone who a year ago was not seen as a contender to be a major contender. And Tom Steyer is on that list, and Michael Bloomberg may be on that list as well.
Well, Tom Steyer is going to be on the debate stage next week. Michael Bloomberg is not going to be there. Amy Klobuchar will. Pete Buttigieg will. Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and Joe Biden. Rick, who's the target going to be on next week? Because it does seem like, depending on the poll you look at, a lot of them are kind of in the top three in different places.
Yeah, it's a jumble of a race. There's no question. And I think, though, the Iowa target, a lot of folks still talk about Pete Buttigieg. That's his chance for a breakout moment. And I think there'll be scrutiny on him. Amy Klobuchar is another one to keep an eye on. If she's got a path to the nomination, it has to run through Iowa. We should also just tip our hats to the two front runners at some point, because for all of the tumult there's been in this race, the fact that Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden are 1-2, 2-1 consistently in the polls statewide and national is something of an achievement.
Okay. And finally, we have to talk about the jobs report, Tolu, that came out today. 145,000 jobs in December. Unemployment rate stays steady at 3.5%. The Dow hits another record high today, 29,000 for the first time. President Trump's got to be happy about that, looking at reelection later this year.
Yeah. And he tries to talk about it. I was at his rally in Ohio last night. He spent some time talking about the economy. It's hard for those numbers to break through when you have impeachment going on. You've got a potential war with Iran. You've got the Democratic presidential campaign. But President Trump and his allies are trying to push that message that the economy is strong. And he's taking credit for it. And he's saying that don't go with any of these Democrats because they would tank the economy. And I expect we'll hear much more of that over the next 10 months.
Tolu Olorunipa, White House reporter for The Washington Post, and Rick Klein, political director at ABC News. Thanks to both of you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
NPR's Life Kit wants to help you make changes that actually stick this new year. From how to do dry January to how to start a creative habit. We've got new episodes all month to help you start the year off right. New episodes every Tuesday and Thursday. Listen and subscribe to Life Kit.
The film Just Mercy is out today in theaters across the country, and it tells the true story of lawyer Brian Stevenson and his efforts to exonerate a man on death row.
Why are you doing this?
Why am I a lawyer?
No, no. Why is you a lawyer down here in Alabama taking these cases that ain't nobody gonna pay you for?
When I was a teenager, my grandfather was murdered over a black and white TV. We kept waiting for someone to show up to help. And that's when I realized that outside my community, nobody cared. Because to them, he's just another black man killed in the projects. I know what it's like to be in the shadows. That's why I'm doing this.
In the film, Jamie Foxx portrays the role of Walter McMillan, a black man from Alabama who was wrongly accused and convicted of murder and sat on death row for 6 years. Michael B. Jordan plays the role of Stevenson. This film comes at a pivotal time as states throughout the country are reexamining the use of the death penalty. Joining us now for more on Just Mercy is the inspiration behind the movie and executive producer, Brian Stevenson. Welcome to Here and Now, and congrats on the film.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Yes. Well, Brian, Just Mercy is based on your memoir of the same name. And I hear you were a big part of producing this film, contributing to the writing of the script. How does it feel to have your story up on the big screen like this? Was it something you always wanted to do?
Well, not really. It's kind of surreal to be in this place. I mean, I think, you know, after 35 years of going into jails and prisons and standing next to condemned people facing execution, it never crossed my mind that, you know, that would turn into an experience like this. When I wrote the book, I was just trying to get people closer to the reality of over-incarceration in America, to the problems that we have in this system that I continue to believe treats you better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent. And even after the book was finished, I really didn't have any clue or idea that someone would want to make a film. So it's been really surreal, but it's been pretty exciting. You know, the people involved have been so committed and so dedicated to getting this right that I feel really good about the film, and I'm excited that people will have a chance to see it.
This movie offers a small slice of your life and work. You're the founder of the Equal Justice Initiative, which represents people on death row. And you've also been instrumental in pretty significant reform, the 2012 U.S. Supreme Court decision to ban mandatory life parole for minors convicted of murder. This story in this film focuses on one of your earliest cases, Walter McMillan. How were you able to narrow your work to this story? Why was this one specifically an important one to tell?
Yeah, when I was writing the book, it was just going to be one of maybe 20 or so cases that I talked about at length. But there was so much richness in the Walter McMillan case. I mean, first of all, the crime took place in Monroeville, Alabama, which is where Harper Lee grew up and is the setting of the fictional novel To Kill a Mockingbird. And that community so embraces and romanticizes that story. It was surreal when I began working on this case to have a whole community directing me to the To Kill a Mockingbird Museum, talking proudly about their relationship to that story, while I was trying to get them to pay attention to the plight of an innocent black man who'd been wrongly accused of killing a young white woman. And I just thought there was a lot to explore in the case. Mr. McMillan was poor. He was a person of color. The people who convicted him, I think, had every reason to know that he was not guilty, and yet he was convicted and sentenced to death anyway. They put him on death row before he would actually been tried or convicted of any crime. And there were just so many elements that exposed the way fear and anger has shaped our criminal justice policymaking in this country, and it just was a really powerful medium through which to, you know, talk about these issues.
Mm-hmm. I watched this film with my 12-year-old daughter, and I thought to myself as we watched it that it was a difficult but really important introduction for her to some of the major flaws in the criminal justice system. In 2014, 42% of those on death row were black. It's a big question I'm about to ask you, but how do we begin to grapple with the racist legacy that has really led to these disparities?
I think we do have to begin talking more honestly about our history of racial injustice. I don't think our country has ever engaged in any meaningful process of acknowledging the injustice, the inequality. I think we're a post-genocide society. What we did to Native people was a genocide, and we haven't acknowledged that. And we've allowed systems to continue that have been compromised by these narratives of racial difference. I think the great evil of slavery wasn't involuntary servitude. It was this idea that black people aren't as good as white people. And that continues after the 13th Amendment. And it's why I've argued slavery doesn't end. It just evolves. And we had 100 years of terrorism and lynching and violence where black people were pulled out of their homes and beaten and murdered and drowned and tortured and lynched. And we've never really talked about that. And even though we pay more attention to the civil rights era, we haven't confronted the fact that this presumption of dangerousness and guilt that gets assigned to black and brown people is still with us. It's why these police encounters with young black people that end up with lethal violence are so disruptive and so painful. So I think we're going to have to commit to a process of truth and justice in America. You go to places like South Africa and Germany, and you see evidence of nations that have grappled with their history of apartheid and the Holocaust. But we haven't really done that. In Germany, you can't go 200 meters without seeing markers or stones or symbols that have been placed next to the homes of Jewish families that were abducted during the Holocaust. But in this country, we haven't created that kind of architecture. We haven't created that kind of landscape to cause people to remember and reflect on the challenges created by slavery and lynching and segregation. And I think that leaves us vulnerable to continue, to new manifestations of that legacy, which is what causes people like Walter McMillan to be wrongly convicted, sentenced to death, and almost executed in our contemporary system.
I want to talk with you about your depiction in the movie. After you graduated from Harvard University, you decided to move to Alabama. And there's a scene where your mother, clearly worried about your well-being, says goodbye to you and essentially tells you your exceptionalism won't save you. And it's something in the film that McMillan says as well. Let's take a listen.
You rich boy from Harvard, you don't know what it is down here when you're guilty from the moment you're born. You can buddy up with these white folks and make them laugh and try to make them like you, whatever that is. And you say, yes, sir, no, ma'am. But when it's your turn, they ain't got to have no fingerprints.
Brian, did that really happen? And how did you negotiate your identity and safety with your work?
Yeah, I always tell people that you can't do this kind of work with just ideas in your mind. To make a difference in this space, you've got to have the ideas in your mind fueled by conviction in your heart. And the great gift I have is that I am the great-grandson of people who were enslaved, and they believed in freedom when it wasn't rational to. And I'm the grandchild of people who were terrorized by lynching, and they believed in a better future, even though that didn't seem logical. I'm the child of people humiliated by segregation and Jim Crow, and yet they believed I could be anything I want. And it's that orientation of hopefulness, you know, that has sustained me. You know, we say in the film, and I say when I give talks, I believe that hopelessness is the enemy of justice. If you want to do justice work, you have to be prepared to believe things you haven't seen. And it's what continues to define the work I try to do today.
This film is called Just Mercy, and it really is this idea that mercy fuels your work. The film primarily follows the story of McMillan, who is innocent, but we also see the story of Herbert Richardson, whose homemade bomb killed a young girl. Let's take a listen.
I think they're going to set my execution soon. Last lawyer said there ain't nothing left to do.
There's always something that we can do. Whatever you did, your life is still meaningful. And I'm going to do everything possible to keep them from taking it.
Brian, you've represented countless people who are guilty of their crimes, but you ask for mercy, for us to respect the value of their lives. Can you share more on this idea?
Yeah, I've just learned, I've come to believe that to each of us is more than the worst thing we've ever done. I don't think that if someone tells a lie, they're just a liar. I don't think if you take something, you're just a thief. I think even if you kill someone, you're not just a killer. And justice requires that we understand the other things you are. I believe in holding people accountable. It's not that I'm opposed to punishment, but I don't think we can reduce people to one act. Because I think, you know, ultimately, issues like the death penalty can't be resolved by asking, do people deserve to die for the crimes they've committed? I think the threshold question is, do we deserve to kill?
Is that what you want folks to take away from Just Mercy?
Well, I want them to take away a new understanding about these issues. I've just always believed that if people saw what I see on a regular basis, they'd want the same things I want. I don't think I have some bizarre perspective. Many people, most people in this country, don't want there to be inequality and injustice. They don't want people to treat it unfairly or cruelly. And I just think if you get closer to it, you'll be motivated to say more, to do more. And I do hope people that see this film will walk away with a greater consciousness about why we need to do better in this country when it comes to creating a justice system that is fair and reliable.
That's Brian Stevenson, lawyer, social justice activist, founder and executive producer of the Equal Justice Initiative. His life and work is portrayed in the film Just Mercy, in which he is also the executive producer. Just Mercy is in theaters nationwide today. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
The Consumer Electronics Show wraps up today in Las Vegas. There was the usual fanfare and head-turning product debuts, including robot kittens. But CES also made headlines this year because of a controversial decision to schedule a keynote address by the president's daughter, Ivanka Trump. For more, we're joined now by Peter Kafka, senior correspondent for Recode. Hi, Peter.
Hello.
Well, let's start with Ivanka Trump. What did she talk about and what's been the reaction?
Ivanka Trump talked about something that is pretty anodyne and uncontroversial in most other settings. She gave a talk on, quote, the path to the future of work. It's not unusual for a White House or Washington person to show up at CES and talking about the future of the work. Future of work is the kind of thing that a tech event like CES would be deeply engaged in, or at least talk about a lot. Obviously, it's controversial because she's Ivanka Trump and she is the president's daughter. And people were offended simply by her presence there.
Now, CES is billed as the world's largest consumer electronics show. People in the industry closely watch it every year. What generated the most buzz this year?
You know, there's a sort of recurring narrative about CES, which is it doesn't generate nearly as much buzz as it used to because the biggest companies in consumer electronics, Apple, Facebook, Amazon, Samsung, Microsoft, when they have something they really want to show off, they don't do it at CES. Mm. They do it at their own events. And also, by the way, if you want to show someone something that you want them to buy next fall, you don't come out with it in January. You do it in the summer or early fall. So what you end up with is a lot of sort of very futuristic stuff that may not ever show up in the market or by companies that can't command the same kind of attention that an Apple or Samsung or Apple or an Amazon could.
That said, what was big?
That said, one thing that I heard a lot of folks talking about, there's some self-selection bias, is the launch of a new video service, not a gadget, but something you can stream to your phone called Quibi. This comes to you from Meg Whitman, who used to run Hewlett-Packard, and Jeffrey Katzenberg, who's a big deal in Hollywood, used to run DreamWorks. Before that, he was at Disney. This is a mobile-only video service, and the idea is there's plenty of stuff you can watch on your phone right now, but their stuff will be better, and you will pay for it.
There's also a device that's getting some attention, Samsung Cero TV, whose display rotates to a vertical position at the touch of a button, mimicking a smartphone screen.
That ties into Quibi actually quite nicely, because one of the big selling points of Quibi is you can watch the video with your phone either up or turned to the side, and then this Cero TV sort of tackles the same problem in the opposite direction, saying, we'll turn the whole device for you. And then it's a nod to the idea that people are consuming video on things like TikTok and Instagram, and they generally hold their phone up when they do that, as opposed to the sort of landscape mode that people are used to watching TV and movies on. And if you want to be cynical about it, and maybe you should be, this kind of shows you that we're sort of maybe near the end of the innovation cycle in consumer tech. If we're literally talking about which way you turn your screen,
right,
it seems like a fairly small advance.
Okay, and I'm going to give you 30 seconds to tell us about robot kitties. What's that all about?
Your guess is as good as mine. I would not put one in my house. CES is a great place to go see things like robot kitties or futuristic sex toys or lots of stuff that maybe you didn't know you want and maybe you'll never get, but at least it's a good place to talk about that kind of thing.
That is Peter Kafka, senior correspondent for Recode, with some of the highlights from CES, which is wrapping up today in Las Vegas. Peter, thank you.
Got to go buy those robot kitties now. Thank you.
Exactly.
Tensions with Iran have seemed to ease slightly after that country's strike in response to the U.S. killing of General Qassem Soleimani last week. But there are still questions about why President Trump authorized the assassination and who has been advising him through this crisis. John Hudson is national security reporter for The Washington Post. Welcome.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
I want to start with the major player in the Trump administration, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. He stood behind the decision to kill Soleimani, and today he announced with the Treasury Secretary new sanctions against Iran.
The reason that Secretary Treasury and I are here this morning is to continue this campaign, our strategic effort to get Iran to behave in a way that doesn't continue their 40-year-long effort to terrorize the world.
John, you and your colleagues report that Pompeo has long had a focus on Iran. He had been advocating for killing Soleimani for some time. Can you lay out his role in the last week?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has been fixated on Iran, really dating back to the time when he was a member of Congress. But, you know, in the last week, what we've seen is a number of things come into place that gave Pompeo an opportunity to really be the central actor in pushing for this really brazen attack on a member, a senior member of a foreign military, which really hasn't been done since World War II. So some of the key things that came into place, Secretary Pompeo has talked to Trump about killing Soleimani dating back months ago, according to a senior official I spoke to. For a long time, the Pentagon has been very opposed to this idea and very risk averse when it comes to rising tensions with the U.S. and Iran. And that's mostly based to a broader goal that the Pentagon has of reallocating resources away from the Middle East and maybe towards East Asia and China, really trying to fulfill Trump's desire of getting out of the Middle East.
Let's talk about another person in the administration who also agrees with Pompeo. That's Defense Secretary Mark Esper. And both Esper and Pompeo happened to be in the same class at the U.S. Military Academy. How much has their relationship factored into the president's decision-making process?
So officials have told me that those two men, Pompeo and Esper, were in lockstep. And having known each other for their entire adult lives, they have had some fights since Esper has led the Pentagon, but they do really understand each other. And so they went into this meeting, this important Mar-a-Lago meeting where the options were presented to President Trump. And they were really on the same page. We're told that Pompeo was definitely more enthusiastic in urging the president to take this step. But Esper was also comfortable with that option of killing Soleimani. Otherwise, he wouldn't have provided that option to the president, we're told by his aides.
There's been lots of turnover in this administration. Secretary Esper became defense secretary this summer. The last confirmed secretary was Jim Mattis. Some have speculated that this Soleimani attack would not have happened under Mattis. What kind of defense secretary has Esper been?
Esper, in many ways, has allowed the president to embrace his instincts on a range of policies. The only area where we've really seen Esper push back is when it comes to the military justice system, where he's tried to protect his ability to control the Pentagon and preserve the military justice system. But in terms of the president's policies, and especially when it comes to very aggressive policies against Iran, as we've seen in the last few days, he has been very open to the president's moves. And I'm told by aides that that has been really critical in this new, more aggressive phase getting approved in the current environment.
I also want to talk about National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien. He also has a big role in this crisis. O'Brien spoke with NPR Steve Inskeep about the justification of Soleimani's killing. Let's listen.
We had very good intelligence that there was an imminent attack
being
planned. It was imminent. You never know the time and place of these things with perfect particularity. But we had very good information that there were imminent attacks planned against Americans.
Robert O'Brien replaced a very hawkish John Bolton as National Security Advisor. Who is Robert O'Brien and what kind of advisor has he been?
Well, Robert O'Brien was previously serving as the top hostage negotiator for President Trump, and he was sort of famously involved in traveling to Europe for the Aesop Rocky case, which some people raised criticisms about because the American rapper is not necessarily viewed as a hostage. But anyway, you're exactly right that he does not bring the type of big personality that and really extreme sort of hawkishness that former National Security Advisor John Bolton brought. He's generally, like Esper, viewed as not a massively powerful figure within the cabinet. Neither of them have the power and influence and ability to really speak the language that President Trump speaks as Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. So while both of them are there, including National Security Robert O'Brien, Pompeo's desire to push these things through, and especially a hawkish policy on Iran, has been viewed as more critical and more influential in the last few days.
As I mentioned with Secretary Esper, there's been a lot of turnover at the White House. The administration is now on its fourth national security advisor, its fifth head of Homeland Security. There's talk that Secretary Pompeo may be on his way out. How do you think all of this change has impacted the decision-making process?
Well, it's a great question because you're right. There's always has been this lingering feeling that Secretary Pompeo might run for the Senate in Kansas, although his aides had a very important meeting with Senator Mitch McConnell earlier this week where they ruled that out. There's still obviously a lot of time that Pompeo could get into this race, but that's always going to be sort of lingering over the horizon. So we've had a lot of staff turn, and that's resulted in really different types of personalities coming in and making an impact on policy. Obviously, Trump is always at the center of it. But he's famous for asking all those around him to weigh in on a variety of national security decisions, regardless of whether they have a long history in national security or a fairly shallow resume.
Tensions we've been reporting have subsided somewhat after what some are calling Iran's largely symbolic attack on U.S. bases in Iraq. But it still feels like a volatile situation, especially now that Iraqi's prime minister is asking the U.S. to withdraw forces. Based on your knowledge of this team that we currently have right now, where do you think their priorities lie? I mean, does that tell us anything about the U.S.'s next steps in advising the president?
Well, in terms of priorities, you just saw in the last few minutes a statement from the U.S. State Department pushing back on Iraq's pretty direct request for the United States to leave Iraq. State Department is now saying that they are not interested in entertaining any conversations about a U.S. withdrawal from Iraq. And so moving forward, we've seen a position that the Trump administration has embraced, which is not about to leave Iraq anytime soon, even though the strike against Soleimani has raised – really inflamed the situation in Iraq and infuriated Iraqi leaders. Now, that was a bit surprising because, as we all know, President Trump came into office pledging to withdraw the United States from the Middle East. Now he's actually threatening countries with sanctions who don't allow the U.S. to stay in the Middle East. So it's been quite a twist and turn, and no one can quite say where this goes. I think another important point to remember is you're correct that the tensions have started to lower and reduce following the strike and the lack of casualties at the U.S. bases that were hit. However, the Iranians have a long memory, and there is no guarantee that they will view launching a few ballistic missiles at U.S. bases with no casualties as significantly reciprocal to the killing of a very senior, very beloved commander that they had that was killed outside of the Baghdad airport. It's very possible that Iran uses its asymmetric capabilities and really meets out its own revenge on its own timescale. So I don't think anyone should be too safe and secure in thinking that we've sort of seen our way out of the woods yet.
John Hudson, national security reporter for The Washington Post, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
With the torrent of news recently, you may have missed an item about Amazon. It has blocked its third-party sellers from using FedEx for delivery. Our next guest says that's another sign of the coming collapse of FedEx. Scott Galloway is professor of marketing at New York University's Stern School of Business. Scott, welcome.
Thanks very much, Jeremy. Good to be here.
So you write something that is pretty surprising, which is you say in the next 24 months, FedEx will either be acquired or lose an additional 40% plus in value. Why do you say that?
So I think entire industries have now been what I call featureized, and that is these incredibly low-margin, difficult businesses are being used as components to make high-margin, more scalable businesses stickier. So you have what is arguably the most dominant firm in retail now using fulfillment as a means of trying to establish greater loyalty across their loyalty program, in this case Prime. So I think FedEx is being featureized, if you will.
It's interesting because when I'm, you know, driving on the highway, I feel like I still see more FedEx trucks than Amazon Prime trucks, but maybe that's wrong.
No, you do. Amazon has a fraction of the capital expenditure of a FedEx, but they start with several advantages. It's kind of clean sheet design. And also, as big tech is becoming famous for, they move to sort of this algorithm of exploitation, and that is their The reality is Amazon will have a much lower cost base because they will not have things like health benefits or paternity leave for their drivers. And granted, that's not – it's not true for all FedEx drivers because some of them are contract workers. But the cost base, the cost structure will be lower. The technology will be better. And to be blunt, fulfillment and delivery is all about trust. And the most trusted brand in the world right now is Amazon.
Interesting. And Amazon had a much better on-time delivery performance over the holidays than FedEx.
That's correct. But some of this is reality and some of it is perception. In the financial markets, perception is almost as important. And that is Amazon is now able to perform what I refer to as a Jedi mind trick against FedEx in the form of now that they are in the business or officially in the business of fulfillment. In the last 2 years, FedEx has shed about 40% of its value while Amazon has increased its value 30%. And you continue to see a further erosion in the stock price of FedEx, even if it's not supported by the fundamentals, because the markets have come to believe that once Amazon sets its sight on a industry, that every other player in the industry begins to shed value to Amazon. And this seeds a lot of advantage to Amazon because their cost of capital goes down. It enables them to sort of fulfill the promise, if you will, or make their own future by massively investing in that category to the extent that other players can't invest.
Now, why is FedEx in such a worse position than the other big delivery service that we think of, which is UPS?
I think FedEx has not innovated. I think internally they've been very focused, or the CEO has been focused on tax avoidance. And just as a consumer, if you look at the experience, whether it's the user interface, their on-time delivery relative to Amazon or UPS, they're just substandard. So I think FedEx is the most vulnerable of the logistics and fulfillment players.
And just to give our listeners some of the statistics here, Amazon Logistics is already shipping over 2.5 billion packages annually in the U.S., 3 billion for FedEx in the U.S., 4.7 billion for UPS. That's according to Morgan Stanley estimates. How did Amazon get into delivery and gain so much ground so quickly in the industry?
So Amazon, it's the boring stuff that adds shareholder value. And Amazon saw an opportunity to go vertical, if you will, and that is they control the front end of e-commerce, and that is the interface online with their retail offering. And Amazon, it also puts Amazon strengths because this is exceptionally complicated, takes incredible operational excellence, a facility with data, and quite frankly, access to billions and billions of dollars and cheap capital. And Amazon has all of those things.
And Amazon is playing hardball with its competitors. It's blocked its third-party sellers from even using FedEx.
Not only that, Jeremy, but they announced it a couple weeks before Christmas publicly. And to do that before the holidays and embarrass FedEx is kind of, I equate it, the analogy I would use is staging a mock homecoming queen ceremony and then pouring pig's blood on somebody. This was really calling FedEx out and doing it at the worst moment possible. This was a strategic stabbing, if you will.
If you were advising Fred Smith at FedEx or the other leaders there, what would you tell them to do?
Sell.
sell the company?
FedEx is really behind an eight ball here. I think FedEx needs to sell to another player. I would argue the best or most likely candidate is Walmart, who would then be like Amazon vertical, and that is control the front end and control the back end. So my advice, sell.
I have to say, Scott, as I'm hearing you talk about this, and you obviously know this industry very well, my big thought on this is with all of this movement to online shopping and all of this movement to delivering everything that we used to go out and buy, there's just so much more packaging. Are they thinking as much about reducing that amount of waste as they are about how to deliver things faster?
You know, that's a great question. I don't know if it's getting the attention it warrants. We've heard about a lot of, you know, plans for innovation and different types of packaging and different types of materials. So I'd like to think they're thinking about this, but the reality is that the music doesn't match the words yet. There's a lot more hype, a lot more words than there is actual activity or action.
That's Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at the New York University Stern School of Business. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.